Our guest is Kathleen Hirsch. She's the author of the book Songs from the Alley. It's been published recently by Tickner and Fields. Kathleen Hirsch has been a staff writer for the Boston Phoenix and has also taught writing at Harvard University and Brown University. She's contributed articles to a number of publications, including the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, and Working Woman. She began the process of writing the book as a volunteer at the Pine Street Inn, which is the largest shelter in Boston for the homeless and one of the oldest in the nation. She got to know the people who were working there, the staff, the women who came there, and was allowed a kind of access that no reporter before her had been granted. Part of the result is the book Songs from the Alley. As we talk, again, if you have questions, you're invited to become a part of the conversation. All you need to do is pick up your telephone and call us. Ms. Hirsch, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What was it that drew you into writing about the homeless?
Well, that's a good question. I've always done social issues reporting. I love moving about the city and kind of putting my finger on the sensitive points in urban culture. But I specifically became interested in the homeless because I was seeing the problem becoming so much more visible on city streets, both here in Boston and in New York and Washington. And I felt that no one really was getting at some of the more troubling issues, maybe some of the deeper issues, of the problem of homelessness. We were all looking at people on the streets and in the subways and saying, how did they get here? And I think those of us in the press who began writing a couple of feature stories at holiday time or doing interviews on morning talk shows were getting only a very narrow perception of what the problem was really all about, and that was beginning to trouble me. And in 86, when I began the book, I felt that I really needed to do something more than just interview people and do a standard kind of journalism. I felt like I really needed to immerse myself in the subculture of homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And see it as nearly as possible the way homeless people themselves see their experiences.
Well, you spent a lot of time working as a volunteer and talking with people at the Pine Street Inn.
Right.
Tell us about the inn. What kind of a place is it?
Well, the inn has gone through a number of incarnations, and it's very long and respectable history. It was founded in 1914, actually by a Chicago magnate who opened a house for, I think it was called the Dawes Hotel for Men in Chicago, and there was another one open there for women. And for some reason, I'm not quite sure, perhaps he had family in Boston, Mr. Dawes opened a Rufus Dawes Hotel for Men in Boston, and the purpose in those years was to provide cheap housing for the people who were working on the railroads, were moving between cities, really had no permanent place to live. And the Dawes Hotel remained that sort of a place down through the 50s and 60s, although no longer really for migrant workers. It was more for the Skid Row population that had developed in Boston. And in time, of course, the population changed in recent times. In the 60s, the inn was taken over by a group of urban priests in Boston, and they ran it as a three hots and a cot kind of place up through the 70s, and then began to realize that the population they were serving was really changing. It wasn't just the chronic alcoholics that we associate with every city's Skid Row. It was deinstitutionalized mentally ill people who either had never received proper housing after they'd been released from hospitals or had received the housing and then hadn't been able to stay in housing. So there was that population, and then increasingly there were more and more women. So now the inn houses about 800 people a night in its let's say its mother ship. It also runs a number of satellite shelters in the winter months. There's a year-round 50-bed shelter for women in another location, which is where I did most of my research, and then they run several overflow shelters that easily sleep up to 300 men a night.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much what we're looking at. In terms of programming in the shelter, it's minimal. there is a clinic that's open every day for people to take their medications, soak their feet, any kind of wounds they get, or blisters, or the kinds of typical health problems that street people develop because they really have no, they're constantly walking and moving around and have no place during the day to wash. And there's a psychiatric nurse on staff, actually several of them, but you're talking about a caseload of almost 700 people, so the two or two and a half people on staff in that capacity really have their hands full. Hmm. That's about it.
I think that it was, if I remember right, it wasn't until 1980 at this place that they opened up, formally opened up a unit for women.
That's correct.
And that the first shelter in the city for women opened in 74.
That's right.
And I think in many communities there's a real problem of services for homeless women.
Very much so.
I mean, it's bad for men, but at least there have traditionally been places for men to go and not nearly as many places for women. And that
right.
for homeless, you know, that it's that they face some of the same problems that men do, and yet it's different. How is it different?
It is different. I think that's the point you're raising is a really important point. When a lot of the women's shelters did finally open, they imitated the male model, and it's really inadequate for women. Women have a totally different relationship to space, for one thing. Let's leave aside for a minute what it's like to be a homeless woman on the streets. It's very dangerous. But women, you know, traditionally have been the homemakers, and I mean that in every sense of the word. I don't just mean cooking and doing the laundry and keeping the house clean. I mean that they have created the emotional ambiance and energy in home life. I think women do have a very different relationship to space. It's extremely difficult for women to be in these massive open lobbies and open dormitory situations that are the kinds of things that shelters are opening. You know, by contrast, men at many points in their lives have had the experience of barrack-type shelters, if they've been in the military, for that matter, if they've been in the Boy Scouts. Women coming into shelters like this have a real problem maintaining a sense of integrity, a sense of privacy, a sense of safety. And as a result, you know, there are a number of women who simply don't use the shelters, because they feel safer staying on the streets by themselves. And Wendy, one of the main characters in Songs from the Alley, is a street woman. She rarely uses the shelters for a number of reasons that maybe we can get into later on. But one of the reasons I was interested in chronicling her story was because she provided such an interesting contrast, and I think a provocative contrast, to the other woman in the book, a woman named Amanda, who is a... was a very typical shelter guest. She was a woman who accepted the services that American society currently offers homeless people. She went to the Pine Street Inn. Getting to the second part of the question, I guess, what is it like to be a homeless woman? It's extraordinarily dangerous. Most homeless women who are on the streets at night don't sleep at night. They walk. And we're talking about up to 20 miles a day. The theory being that if you keep moving, you're safer than if you find yourself a comfortable location and fall asleep. If you do that, you're going to be prey to everything imaginable. So women are seriously sleep deprived on the street. They, you know, go from area to area, lighted area to area in the course of the night, and during the day, if they can, they get into the library and try to snooze, or find a very public place in which to just rest for a couple of hours at a time. It's very difficult.
I wanted to talk in some detail about the two women that you profile. Before that, I wonder how it is that you chose them. And I think I remember at one point in the book you write that it wasn't so much a case of you choosing them as them choosing you.
Right.
And also, as you just said a bit ago, that they, perhaps for you, they somehow represent a lot of other women in their circumstances, in the choices that they've made. Was it a purposeful choice to pick these two women?
No, actually, When I began this project, I went through several different stages with it. My first idea was to work with about 5 women. And I just have to sort of laugh right now when I think about it, because with Wendy and Amanda alone, my manuscript, before I cut it down to a manageable size, came out to 900 pages. So I don't know what I would have done with 5 women. Mm-hmm. I think the book would have been a very different book. I think it would have appeared more in the form of case studies. And that was the last thing I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book that would be readable, that would really engage the reader, that would bring them into the lives of a couple of people in such a way that they would feel like they were living their experiences with them. And so I quickly resigned the idea of working with 5 women to the out basket, and then decided that maybe I would work with 3 women, and that one of the women would be someone who was a mother who was traveling with her children on the streets. And I ultimately decided not to include that kind of a homeless person in the book for a couple of reasons. One, and most important, and I think this is something a lot of people don't realize, the system of shelters that serves homeless families is very different from the shelter network that serves single adults. Occasionally you will have a family walk into a shelter for single adults just because they have no other place to go. They don't know where to go, and usually they're sent to a family shelter. But it seemed to me that I had to do one thing or the other. The other thing that made my job easier in dealing with single adult women and the whole issue of homelessness as it affects that population is that Jonathan Kozol began a book on homeless families almost at the same time that I began my research for Songs from the Alley. So I felt that that work was going to be done by someone else, and it was just as well for me to focus on new ground that no one else had really looked at. I didn't have any preconceptions beyond that. In fact, I had no idea when I started the research that the women I would meet would come to seem so representative to me of so many other women, and also would help to identify for me what I think is one of the major issues in the problem right now, and that is, what do we do to move beyond shelters as a means of solving this problem? It's clear to me, having worked with Amanda now for 3 years and Wendy for as long, that shelters are just the beginning of the answer. And that we need to do a lot more, both in the shelters and beyond shelter, than we're doing at this point if we're really going to solve the problem of homelessness.
Our guest this morning is Kathleen Hirsch. Her book is Songs from the Alley. And we're talking about homelessness in the United States, really focusing on the experience in Boston, but I think that many of the things that the book has to say are just as applicable to any place else across the country. As we talk, again, if you have questions, you're invited to call in. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL is our toll-free line. Well, let's talk about Amanda. Here is a woman who, it seems, was not a wanted child. Her parents didn't seem to really want her, or she had an older sister. Her parents were neglectful. They were abusive. Her father beat her badly over a period of years. When she was a teenager, her mother was hospitalized for psychiatric problems. When she was not very much into her young adulthood, really broke away from home. Actually, earlier than that, she was sent away to boarding school by her grandfather, who was, I think, trying to get her away from her parents. As an adult later on, she was sort of in and out of work. She lived on and off with her sister. And I guess that at one point, she just... I guess the phrase you use is she, at 30, she ran away from home.
That's
of course,
right.
she had really, maybe had done that a long time before, and ended up at a women's shelter. How did you, and of course, you spent a lot of time explaining all of this and how it is she came from childhood to be there. Mm-hmm. But here's a person that you read about, and you just get the feeling that it's someone who has, for all of her life, been lost,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and is really looking for a home, but and maybe just doesn't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really perceptive. I want to step back even a little bit farther to complete the portrait of this woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I hadn't read Songs from the Alley and didn't know Amanda, the image that would immediately come to mind from your very accurate description of her home life would be a kid who'd grown up in a poverty situation, perhaps an inner-city situation. All of those stereotypes come to mind immediately. Here was, you know, it's easy for us to categorize the Amanda that you've described and say, well, you know, these are the problem people in our society, and they're totally hopeless. There's nothing we can really do to salvage this kind of person who's been lost from childhood. But the picture that neighbors saw was that Amanda came from very respectable middle-class parents. Both of her parents were college-educated people. They were both highly trained artists. Her mother was an illustrator. Her father was a very promising painter who, in fact, won a traveling scholarship his final year in art school. And the couple had planned on moving to Europe and spending their adult years in all of the exotic capitals of the world, painting and living a very esoteric kind of existence.
Mm-hmm.
When the children came, I think the bubble burst, and they decided they couldn't live this bohemian life in the city anymore. They had to move to a lily-white suburb south of Boston, and Amanda's father became an engineer to support the girls and built a lovely cape for the family. And, you know, so this is part of the picture as well. These are not children that walk around with you know, brands on them. In fact, I think one of the big problems for Amanda was that in those years, in the 50s and the early 60s, no one was really attuned to the telltale signs of abuse and neglect. Certainly her classmates knew something was wrong with her because, you know, like kids always do, they pick out the most vulnerable member of their group and, you know, really make them the scapegoat. And, you know, poor Amanda would get to school many mornings after a horrendous, nightmarish ride on the school bus where everyone would be pulling her hair or grabbing her book bag from out of her hands, and she would be soaking wet. She would have wet herself in the anxiety and the trauma of what she'd gone through. So I think the picture, I wanted to complete that picture because
mm-hmm.
I think it's so easy for us to kind of put this population at arm's length and say they're so different from us, there's nothing we can do to help them. Well, no, in fact, that's not true. Someone like Amanda, I think, tells us very clearly that what's going on in a lot of American homes today is laying the foundation for the future generations of homeless in this country.
Yeah,
and that we need to understand that if we're going to begin to prevent future homelessness.
And that it really cuts across all kinds of lines of social and economic status and levels of education.
That's correct.
And all that kind of stuff.
That's correct. I mean, I would say that the highly mobile two-career couple that neglect their kids in one form or another are setting up future problems every bit as much as working class parents who, you know, where one member of the family has a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just to fill out the picture. But I think your observation about Amanda looking for a home that she never had is absolutely right. And I think that there are a lot of Americans out there who are doing that. Some of us are in homes, and some of us are on the street. But I think in Amanda's case, she went to the shelter looking for a healthy relationship with a mother figure. She was looking for a staff person who could listen to her and could affirm her and could help her rebuild a self-esteem that was just shattered at a very early age. When I met her, she'd been chronically homeless for 6 years. She'd been in and out of the shelter 3 times. she managed the first and second time to get herself back into mainstream society, as we would call it, I suppose. The first time around, she moved back in with her sister for almost a year. And the second time, she met and fell in love with, not surprisingly, an alcoholic, and moved in with him, and they maintained a relationship for some time, and she had a full-time job, and then that relationship fell apart, and once again, she was left with this overwhelming sense of emptiness and lack of connection to anything around her or anybody around her, and a sense that life just really wasn't adding up to much that meant anything. And that was when she ran away for the third time, and that's when I met her.
Mm-hmm. It's described in the book that, if it's the occasion I'm thinking about, that at one point she just left. She had an apartment, but she just went out the door. She locked the door. She left everything that she had inside and walked away, not really even knowing where she was going to go.
Yep, that's right. That's exactly what she did. Now, you know, a lot of people end up leaving home for the shelters in much more dramatic and traumatic situations. A lot of the women in the shelter had been battered wives, had perhaps had some midlife crisis or menopausal breakdown or something, and had been briefly institutionalized and then really abandoned by their husbands. There was one woman who I was really fond of in the shelter, and it really broke my heart every night. She would come in. She's a beautiful black woman. She worked full-time during the day, very dignified woman, and she would come into the showers, which was the first stop for almost everybody coming in the door, and then she'd have her dinner, and the first thing she would do after dinner is go to the public phone, which was very public. It was right in the middle of the dining room, and she would call her children, and she would ask them how their days had been. And she was so proud of them. They were both doing very well in school. And you could just see the love and pain on her face that she knew that the courts would never allow her to have custody of the children, that the husband had really done a number on her and had custody of the kids, and that she just sort of had to accept the situation. And I think in her case, it was that heartbreak that made it so difficult for her to imagine getting her life together and getting out of the shelter and leading a nominally normal life, because for her it wouldn't be normal. She wouldn't be with her children. But, you know, most of the women who I met in the shelter were not mentally ill, were not by any means illiterate. They were completely aware of what had happened to get them to the point they were at. And like Amanda, needed people to believe in them and to value them, and to give them the confidence to think about taking that next step out of the shelter.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by something that Amanda says, and I wrote it down, and I wondered if you could talk about it and talk about what it means. She, at one point, and this is after the third time that she ran away, this time that we just talked about, at the point at which you met her, she says, talking about living in the shelter, "Here, secrets have another meaning altogether. Secrets are all you have. How you share them and hoard them, even invent some, determines how well you survive."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have a home surrounding you, a physical place that not only contains your cherished possessions, but also your memories and associations, you have to carry your home in your head. And it's very scary to think about sharing that. That's what she meant by the secrets. You know, if you share something too much and too easily, it becomes cheap. And you keep what you really cherish to yourself. You also keep to yourself the really painful memories. And I think this was what I wasn't prepared for when I went into my research, was the patience it would require and the incredible level of trust that I would have to develop with Wendy and Amanda to make them feel comfortable enough in sharing those really painful memories. I mean, Amanda told me things she had never told anyone before about her father's treatment of her, and the same thing is true of Wendy. Those are secrets you tend not to want to share with people because you need to look as together and confident as you can be. You hide your tears. You don't cry in front of the other women. If you need to feel sad, often, as like Lucky does at one point in the book, the character of Lucky, she was in one of the women's group's discussions, and it was so painful to her that she just had to walk out into the vestibule in the dark and sit down in her nightgown and smoke a cigarette and put on her sunglasses and pretend she wasn't where she was. Hmm. So that's what she meant by secrets, the deepest parts of oneself.
This morning on Focus, Kathleen Hirsch is our guest. We're talking about her book, Songs from the Alley. This morning on Focus, we're talking with Kathleen Hirsch. Her book is Songs from the Alley. It's a book about homelessness, focusing on Boston, although it does, I think, say some things that will apply to other communities across the country. It's recently published by Tickner and Fields. Kathleen Hirsch has been a staff writer for the Boston Phoenix. She also has written articles for other publications, including the Boston Globe, the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, and Working Woman magazine. If you have questions, you'd like to participate in the program, please feel free to call 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. That's the toll-free number. Well, we talked about one of the two women you profile. Let's talk about the other. Mm-hmm. Talk about Wendy. Here again is a child that had a very difficult childhood. Her father was abusive, cheated on her mother. The two parents separated when they were... When Wendy was rather young, she talks about having been abused by her mother. She was a very shy, probably very intelligent young girl, suffered some medical problems when she was young, had to spend a bit of time in hospitals. She says that she was sexually assaulted by her stepfather and a brother when she was a teenager, and when she was 15, started drinking and continued to have problems with alcohol virtually all of the rest of her life. She was pregnant when she was a teenager and she had an abortion. She never really seemed to have any permanent place, went through a lot of different relationships with men that all were rather destructive and abusive. And it was just, again, this morning, just before we started looking through the end section of the book, as you wrote about what it was like for her to live on the street, and it's very difficult to read, and I'm sure for you it must have been difficult too, because you got the feeling that you were watching somebody die by inches.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting observation. In fact, other people have said exactly the same thing, that they come away from the book feeling in many ways more drawn to Wendy than to Amanda, because she's such a vibrant personality. She's so alive in her wit, in her gregariousness, in her humor. Her memory is phenomenal. Her memory is absolutely phenomenal to me. There's no doubt in my mind that this is an incredibly intelligent woman. And people have said that they feel so drawn to her and yet just feel so fatalistic about her future. I mean, she's a young woman. She's 34 years old, and she's been on the streets almost half of her life, off and on.
And you, reading about both of these people, another sort of feeling that I get is that here are two people that have packed a lifetime full of pain into just a couple of decades, practically, that you know, they've endured enough, as much as people would in 60 or 70 or 80 years
of
living.
Right. And in fact, Wendy, in one of her little essays, I included some of her writing as well as some of Amanda's, because it's so vital and real. And at one point in one of her essays, she says, "I've lived through 10 times more than people 3 times my age have lived through, and they probably wouldn't even believe half of what I've been through." And I think it's true. In fact, one interviewer asked me if I purposely chose Amanda and Wendy because their lives were so dramatic, they would make great stories. I had to laugh because if you have had the experience I have of living in really in a shelter for a couple of years, you realize that everyone there has had incredibly turbulent lives, not happy lives, but very, very full lives. I think they all feel at this point that they've been through so much that the difficulty in adapting to what we would call normal life is just overwhelming. And that's another reason why I wanted to write about a couple of people in such detail, because I think it's inevitable reading the book that you look at these two women and say, you know, how could they return to mainstream society? And if they were to want to, what kinds of space would we need to allow them? What sort of flexibility and compassion and understanding would we have to have for their personalities? I mean, the shape of their lives, even if they were to return to mainstream America, would be different than the shapes of our lives. And we need to make a place for people who are different from us in the society. And I think that increasingly that's become difficult for Americans to do.
Hmm. Well, Amanda, she certainly had some support. And it made it possible for her to eventually leave the shelter and go and begin living on her own.
That was the key for her. Was the key.
It also seems that she did find within herself some. She wasn't completely leaning on other people. She got to the point where she found some of the strength in herself to lean on herself, and that Wendy, maybe the problem is that she had no support, virtually no support, nobody else that she could lean on to get to the point where she would be strong enough to support herself.
Yeah, no, I think you've described it perfectly. That's exactly what happened. When Amanda met up with Jackie, the counselor in the shelter who she got so close to, who she began to call Mom, that was a key moment in her life. And it was by virtue of that relationship that she gained the self-confidence to go out and find herself a job again and then move into an apartment. I think Wendy, at points in her early life, had that kind of support. And I think there was potential with the one relationship that she developed with the man she met in perhaps her 10th visit to a detox facility in Florida, and with whom she really set up a life for herself. I think that if that relationship hadn't disintegrated the way it did, she could have made it at that point. She continues to connect up with men on the street who have a dream of getting off the streets. The last relationship that she's in the book with Kurt, a street fellow who's very tender, very gentle guy, in many ways. He's 4 years younger than she is, and he really, when he fell in love with her, he dreamed of staying sober and getting them a room. And in fact, he went to the state prison, which runs a longer term detox program for homeless people, and it's a pretty abysmal place, but he took the step of going out the 60 miles to this, what used to be an old work farm, and stayed there for a while and to plan their future and to dry out, and came back and discovered that in his absence she'd neglected a pretty serious wound on her arm that had become so infected that she was on death's door, literally. And we see this happening over and over with her, that she seems to get involved in these destructive dynamics with someone who's trying to help her. She will try to undermine the good and the positive in a very self-destructive way, and then that bounces off the boyfriend, and then he becomes his own self-contempt kicks in I think in the case of Kurt, that's what happened, and then he gets angry at her, and the whole thing just devolves into an impossible situation again. She and I have become very close friends, but even with me, she really backs away when I start to actively suggest that she think about getting into a detox program again. And I really haven't made my peace with what one does with a Wendy, because I care for her very much, and I want to be there as someone who can help her when she's ready to make that decision. But I can't force her into a program. And it's a big problem. It's a problem we have with that segment of the homeless population.
I think that some people will listen to your descriptions of Wendy and will find her perhaps fitting into a collection of stereotypes that they already have about people who live on the street, and that in doing that, they are perhaps misunderstanding. Maybe one way to try to approach it is by asking you, as you begin to know these people and get to know the people in the shelters, and what sort of preconceptions, perhaps, even though you said you tried to go into it without any, what sort of preconceptions did you find you had to put aside as you got to know these people as people?
I think that's a great question. I went into it suspecting that the argument I would end up making was that homelessness was largely the result of economic displacement. That was the dominant interpretation that most advocates for the homeless were propounding in the years from the time they got organized, the early 80s, up until very recently. And for many segments of the homeless population, that rings very true. With homeless families, women who have lost their apartments because the rent's gone up and their man has left and they're stuck with the kids and they have no recourse. People who've lost their jobs because of local economies and don't have the skills to compete in a service economy, that kind of thing is happening all over the country. Housing prices are going up. What I had to overcome was the fear on my part that in breaking stereotypes of one order, I might be reaffirming stereotypes of another order. And it was absolutely critical to me to be as honest as I could be about the people I was meeting in the shelters. What I found was that substance abuse had remained a really hidden issue among a lot of commentators on the homeless, and I think for very sincere reasons. I think that in the beginning, when we all started looking at the problem of homelessness, we were so horrified by the idea of people being on the streets that we, and I include myself in that, morally, not that I was writing in this way, but I think morally I was on this bandwagon as well. I think we all felt that it was very important to develop a constituency among as many Americans as possible that to the effect that we needed to do something about this problem and we needed to do something soon. And I think the result was that a lot of us wanted to convince the American public that homeless people were really like ourselves. They just didn't have as much money as we did. And in a land that was increasingly dominated by greed, we needed to readdress our own values and do something about low-income housing and that would solve the problem. As I got to know people in the shelters, I began to have real difficulties with the superficiality of that analysis. I began to realize that almost every homeless person I met was poor, often as a result of being homeless, not necessarily as a cause of being homeless. In other cases, they were poor because they had come from dysfunctional families and had never, like Amanda, had the peace of mind as a child and as an adolescent, going to school, to be able to concentrate enough on her studies to even envision some kind of a future for herself beyond a really low-level job. Or people who had come out of horrendous school systems. And I increasingly began to realize that we needed to talk about homelessness not only as an economic problem, but as a cultural problem, and to understand that there were many systems, public systems that were feeding the problem. Inadequate schooling was feeding the problem. Forms of institutional racism were feeding the problem. Forms of institutional sexism were feeding the problem. And a lot of informal lifestyle realities in this country were feeding the problem, like dysfunctional families. So when it came to dealing with the substance abuse issue, I felt that it was time to bring that one, as it were, out of the closet, and to do so in a way that would be truly enlightening, rather than would paste a banner across this population and stigmatize them forever. And I think the only way to do that is to, in a compassionate way, try to show how one very bright, very talented young woman became an alcoholic, that it wasn't her fault. This isn't a lifestyle that she chose, that circumstances in her childhood drove her to seek an escape when there was no other escape for her. That there weren't neighbors around saying, hey, things don't look so good in your house. You want to talk about it. There weren't teachers reaching out to her. And I think that if we can begin to see past the label of an alcoholic and realize that, you know, the alcoholics on the street have come from families often that damaged them a lot as kids, and that the problems of alcoholism that we experience, or drug addiction that we're experiencing across the board in this society, is also being felt in the street population. So that's how I reconciled myself to these issues of stereotypes and what issues to talk about and what issues not to talk about. I felt I had to be just totally honest about what I saw.
We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with Kathleen Hirsch about her book, Songs from the Alley. It is about homeless people in Boston. If you have questions or thoughts, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. You've had the opportunity to spend time in a number of different shelters and watch the way that they work. And I gather that you feel that some shelters are almost just places to stay in an end of the road kind of place. That is, the people who are there don't seem to be going anywhere from there. And that some shelters manage to be places where truly one just stops and one's really on the way to somewhere.
Right. I think that that's true. I think, getting back to what we were saying in the beginning of the conversation, we need to look at both types of shelters and understand clearly what they accomplish and what they don't accomplish. There probably will always be a need in this society, as in any society, for that bedrock place, for people who have hit the skids with a drinking problem or a drug problem and just aren't ready to seek help yet. In those kinds of places, what you're providing is the step between life and death. If what we're about here is trying to provide people with a roof while we are trying to address their needs for a job, for security, for a sense of belonging in community, and for a house, you need to do a lot more than just provide soup at dinner and a bed. I think you need to provide some really high-quality daytime programs in jobs training, in job hunting, in balancing one's checkbook, in personal finance, in life skills in some cases. You know, there are people who are in our shelters who have been on the street for 10, 15, 20 years now. And those are perhaps the most intractable cases, like Wendy, who isn't even really at the point where she goes into the shelter. So she's even a little bit farther out than that in terms of society's ability to help someone along. But I have seen cases where even women who have been on the street for 20 years if they are given truly individual attention and consistent care, if an outreach worker goes to the same park bench where this woman sits for a few hours at night, every night, and just gently and gradually tries to establish some kind of connection with that woman, I have seen that woman go into a shelter and stay in the shelter and within a period of time participate in workshops and discussion groups and even further along be moved into a room. This is the kind of work that is very labor-intensive. It requires a lot of love, a lot of patience, and will cost money. And we, as a society, I think, need to realize that a portion of this population is probably always going to be dependent on some kind of care, some kind of structure. But moving up the spectrum, you have people like Amanda, who are pretty high functioning. And in her case, you know, she was sort of a veteran of the shelters when she came back this third time. And she came through the doors, I think, with not a very clearly defined sense of what she wanted to get out of it. That would be misrepresenting it completely. But I think that there was an inner energy operating, a desire, if you will, to finally come to terms with what it was in her past that has made her life take the course that it did. And if a woman like that or a man coming into the shelter new can be caught right away by a staffer and worked with, the chances of helping that person into a job and into an apartment are that much better. And I think what we need to do in shelters is provide the kind of programming that can help people move along.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get them both in before we have to finish up. We'll go to our line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your talk so far. I'm glad you're speaking about this matter. I live in Champaign, and we, of course, have some street people here, and I find as I'm wandering around campus town and other places that I occasionally bump into them, and usually you bump into them, these are mostly men that I encounter, they're wanting money, which you assume is probably going to buy alcohol, which I usually don't give them. Instead, I try to, you know, talk with them civilly and get to know them a little. Occasionally, I'll buy them some food or something. But one particular question you might want to speak to me and to the listening audience about is, when you encounter a homeless person, mm-hmm. how can you, like a person as an individual, meeting this person on the street and perhaps being tempted to avoid them because they're strange and mm-hmm. in our minds perhaps potentially dangerous, what can we do to deal with them as a person? How can we help them individually if we're called upon to do that or we have a situation where we meet one?
I think what you're doing, for starters, is exactly what I recommend to people when they ask me about panhandling. My response is, better give something of yourself. A little conversation, a little human connection, maybe buying someone a cup of coffee or a sandwich. That, I think, is a real start. And what happens over time, if you consistently work on this relationship with the one or two people who you run into in the course of your week, you find that a kind of camaraderie and trust develops that over time allows homeless people to feel confident about asking you for a favor. And I think if you make it clear that you're available for that, that you would be happy to help them in any way you can, in time you will probably be asked for help. I think one thing that a lot of us are really afraid of in this country is that we'll be asked for more than we can give, that someone will ask us, will sort of get their hooks into us, and that we won't be able to escape. We're happy enough writing a check or volunteering, you know, at a soup kitchen one evening a month, but beyond that, we're really uncomfortable. And I think we sort of have to overcome that in one way or another. And I think the way to start is exactly as I've just described. Test the waters and see how far you can get. And rather than dread being asked for something, be happy that you have that quality of relationship with someone, whereby they feel free to ask you for something.
I hope that gets at the caller's question, and he'll forgive me if I go on and try to squeeze our second caller in here before we have to finish here in line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I don't know if it's good to bring this up, but it seems to me that in our day and age, there are so many people, and sometimes in our own home and in our own family, we have a person that doesn't function as well. Unfortunately, this type of behavior or outlook on life we call normal doesn't fit everybody in the same family.
Right.
And it seems to me that we run into more and more in our society and in our world people that have been told or taught badly that life has no meaning, that ultimately the things we do, the work and the recreation, serve no real purpose. In other words, they believe there are no absolutes in life, any truth. And yet I can't help but think one person that pops in the mind, and while this isn't at the end of the discussion, this is not a good thing to bring up, I think of someone like John Bunyan, who was a child. He was obviously extremely intelligent, but nothing worked for him. And he was a street person who was just full of venom, self-detestation, and life seemed meaningless. And yet, when he began to discover that life does have meaning, he became, and of course in prison, he became an entirely different person. And he, there are so many people that come from the sort of backgrounds or difficulties that you run into with people that have been beacon lights.
That's right.
Of great encouragement for the ages, for all of us.
Right.
I simply wanted to bring that up and get your reaction.
Thank you so much. And I think it's completely appropriate. And I think very much in line with the argument that I conclude the book with, that in this society that is so secular, where so many of us are seeking for some meaning, some toehold, we have two choices. We can either band together only with those people who are exactly like us and feel very comfortable in that kind of setting and pursue our private ambition, or we can do just the opposite. We can open our lives to people who are different. We can tolerate people whose capacities and whose talents are different, and we can nurture what I like to call the non-material, the spiritual parts of our lives, much more than we're doing today. I think that's really at the heart of solving the problem of homelessness.
We're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of our time. Thank you, Kathleen, very much for
talking with us. My pleasure. It's been fabulous.
Our guest, Kathleen Hirsch, is the author of the book Songs from the Alley. It has been recently published by Tickner and Fields.